fun of him. Is that super hearing?
I think we should make fun of him. Because you're late.
You don't want to hear my honest thoughts.
No, I'm not going to.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't have a license.
Today is Thursday, May 4th, 2017. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. And I'm going to take the liberty before we begin of saying welcome to my mother, who's sitting in the back of the room visiting us from New York. Today we're going to be having a special hearing on equity and inclusion in health and tribal affairs and health and human services. And I'm going to allow Representative Alonso Leon to introduce it since she kindly arranged this whole session. Representative.
Thank you, Senator and co-chair. Thanks, everybody, for being here today. I am super excited that we have this amazing opportunity to have folks from DHS and the OHA present to us the fabulous work, the hard work that's happening specifically on diversity and inclusion areas. And we have invited both directors from DHS and OHA, as well as the directors of Tribal Affairs from both agencies. So they're going to share with us the work that they're doing around the state and better acquaint us on the programs that they do. Thank you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, please.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Reginald Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Human Services. Co-chairs, the Oregon Department of Human Services is here with our partner agency, the Oregon Health Authority, and we thank you for the invitation to present our work with the tribes and our work to expand equity and inclusion among our staff and the people that we serve. Before I introduce the panel, I'd like to provide a little context for how these programs operate. You may recall back in 2011, House Bill 2009 extracted several divisions from DHS and merged them with other health-related state agencies to create the Oregon Health Authority. At that time, analysis was done to determine what centralized programs should stay in a single agency or become a shared service. When we use the term shared service, we refer to programs that are managed by one agency but provide services to both agencies. Because DHS and OHA had different needs for tribal relations and equity work, each agency developed its own programs to address specific priorities. For example, DHS is responsible for the statewide implementation of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which focuses on protective services, while OHA concentrated its efforts on health care access and equity. There is frequent collaboration among our programs. Next slide. With that, I'm going to hand off the presentation to the subject matter experts. You can see from the agenda that we're going to start with tribal affairs, and then you'll hear from the equity and multicultural services or inclusion programs. I'm pleased to present Naja Jones to you. Naja directs the DHS Tribal Affairs Unit, reporting to the DHS Director Psyche. Naja provides the direction and oversight for DHS relations with Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes and tribes outside of Oregon. Naja has been with DHS for 4 years. Next is Julie Johnson. She's the Interim Tribal Affairs Director at OHA. Julie works across the agency to coordinate and provide guidance on OHA's programs serving 9 federally recognized tribes and Native American people of Oregon. Julie has been working at OHA for 2.5 years and for the Oregon tribes for more than 20. After the tribal affairs portion of the presentation, you'll hear from Lydia Munoz and Leanne Johnson. Lydia directs the DHS Office of Equity and Multicultural Services, reporting to me. Lydia has been at DHS for 4 years, and prior to joining DHS, she worked 16 years in the governor's office and 2 administrations, serving as the governor's director for the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses. Leanne Johnson is the director of the Oregon Health Authority's Office of Equity and Inclusion. Leanne has been with OHA for 6 years. The last 2, director of the Office of Equity and Inclusion. Prior to coming to the state of Oregon, Leanne was the administrator in higher education and has worked in equity and inclusion for close to 30 years. With that, it's my pleasure to turn the presentation over to Naja Jones. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Richardson.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Naja Jones. I'm the Tribal Affairs Director at DHS. In the presentation today, I'm working with my partner, Julie Johnson at OHA. We do strive continually to be sister agencies in the providing of services and equity to tribal people in Oregon. And we work well together, and it's a pleasure to have Julie up here. Julie is going to be providing a description of the first couple of slides, and then I'll be going into tribal affairs at DHS. Next slide, please.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Julie Johnson, and I'm really happy to be here today. Thank you for inviting us. Working in tribal affairs is truly an honor and privilege to work with the 9 federally recognized tribes and our native people of Oregon and other states. Working in tribal affairs, both of our agencies, like Naja said, work very closely together on a number of issues. And it was starting in 1997 that the first tribal liaison was hired at DHS. And that is just an amazing part of our history, because that liaison has been responsible for all of these many years of building that government-to-government relationship with the tribes and the state agency. So I want to recognize, you know, all of those tribal affairs directors that have been here over time doing the great work that they have done. And now that Naja and I are here in these roles, we are continuing to move that work forward, honoring the government-to-government relationships that we have with the tribes. Through the reorganizations over the years and leadership changes, this position has always stayed at the director's office level, and I think that that's really important because we know that the leadership, you know, we really need to look to them to guide us. And so having this position at that leadership level is very important to the tribes and to us as staff. Our tribal sovereign nations are responsible for the health and safety and welfare of their tribal members, and they take that very seriously. The leadership of the tribes, each individual tribe as their own tribal government, and we work with them individually and collectively both. Tribal sovereignty for Oregon Indian tribes gives them the authority to govern themselves within the United States of America. I think we're still on that side. The federal government has a unique relationship with Indian tribes because of the federal trust responsibility. Some of those things include providing basic social, medical, and educational services to tribal members. The state of Oregon also has this government-to-government relationship, and the tribes administer and operate their own health and human services programs utilizing federal, state, and tribal funding. Oregon maintains that government-to-government relationship with tribes with guidance from the Legislative Commission on Indian Services and meeting the requirements of Senate Bill 770. We work very hard to meet these needs, to address the needs, and do our best to meet those needs for the tribal people in Oregon. The key pieces that we want to make sure that we're compliant with as Senate Bill 770 is the implementing the policy. Every state agency is required to have a policy on the relationship with tribes and how we communicate and coordinate with them, training state staff, coordinating our meetings, attending the government-to-government summit, the LCIS hosts, as well as our health and human services cluster, and providing the annual report to LCIS and the tribes at the end of the year. This is a map of our beautiful state of Oregon, and I really appreciate the map. It was done by the Coquille Indian Tribe. It just shows where our tribes are located, their headquarters are located. Of course, it doesn't show all of the Aboriginal territory of those tribes, but it just shows the unique geographic areas of our tribes. And just knowing that some of our tribes have a lot of similarities with culture and language and traditions based on the region that they're in. So, for example, the coastal areas share a lot of those same things, as well as the plateau tribes. Again, it's our honor and privilege to work with the 9 tribes and be able to meet them at their locations and work with them in that government-to-government relationship.
Okay. The values of state government are clear when working with tribes. We always try to maintain a respectful discourse when we're talking about services and opportunities for tribes to collaborate with us or to seek funding individually. We don't work from an authority model in working with tribes. We work from a model of mutual learning. We believe that the tribes are experts on themselves, and we in turn have topical experts that can share resources and information. One of the things that I very much have a high value for is demonstrating behavior in staff at DHS and in leadership and in working with Julie, that we are considering the unique nature of each of the sovereign nations, that one tribe's needs may be different than another's, and that we need to be responsive to each tribe individually. Next slide, please. This part of the presentation is attempting to build some knowledge if you're not aware of the effect of federal policy on tribes. In the early 1950s, there was a relocation federal program that encouraged tribal members to move to metro areas. And in 2010, for the very first time, anyone could identify themselves as American Indian, Alaskan Native. And as a result of that, we now have a better snapshot of our population, of tribal people, of Oregon people, of Oregon tribal people. And one of the unique considerations for Oregon is that we have, within our metro, Multnomah County, we have the ninth largest Indian population in the country.
Ms. Jones,
yes.
Can I ask both you and Ms. Johnson a question? We have our nine federally recognized tribes, some of whom are actually confederated tribes, so they're multiple tribes put together. And then obviously not everyone who identifies as American Indian or Alaska Native in Oregon is from one of those tribes. How does that affect your ability to serve those populations who come from very different? I mean, if we're talking about somebody who comes to us from the southeastern part of the United States, as you quite rightly point out, even within Oregon, our nine tribes may have very different perspectives on things because of their natural history. How does that affect your ability to serve people from different tribal heritages who live in Oregon?
May I answer first?
Please, whoever wants, it's up to you two.
I very much direct staff to have the mid-range and long-range perspective on serving tribes, that our unique history with the United States, I'm Comanche.
Okay.
And so my tribe is from Oklahoma.
Right.
And we have to recognize that in the sovereignty of each of the tribes, each of them has a right to have a conversation with us about their child welfare, individual case staffing by phone. Knowing that we have hundreds of tribes that reside outside of Oregon is our responsibility to be responsive in the immediate and in the larger scope of meeting need.
And I would just add to that that working with the government, the nine federally recognized tribes governments, is for the Oregon state government-to-government relationship. But yes, we do have that goal of serving all Native Americans in Oregon. I think for Oregon Health Authority, we're really looking at, you know, the H&A indicator, Heritage Native American indicator, as our indicator for our OHP clients. And mm-hmm. So we don't have as much individual interaction the way that DHS does with those people, but sometimes we will, you know, come across cases that people are having issues with receiving services or something that we will try to assist with.
So in follow-up then, I guess what I would ask is, how much of an opportunity do you have to talk with your counterparts in other states, for those states that have them, and get their perspective on, for example, I mean, you have your own Comanche tradition, Ms. Jones, but Navajo is not native to the United to the Northwest. Sioux is not native to the Northwest. Do you have those opportunities to talk with colleagues and get their perspectives on tribes that we don't have in Oregon but whose people may be living here?
It is one of my most favorite things to do. And there are regular convenings by conference call or by national conference of other state tribal affairs directors. And I have relationship with Florida and New York and Minnesota and Iowa, Arizona, New Mexico, all who have significant Native American population and all who have the same responsibility to serve internal tribes and external tribes.
Thank you.
And in this interim role that I've been in, I've had the opportunity to attend some of the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board quarterly board meetings and present at those and learn from my colleagues in Idaho and Washington on some of the ways that they're serving their tribal populations. I do know that the Health and Human Services does have a tribal affairs conference call quarterly that I've just recently been invited to, and so I'm interested in hearing more from other tribes. I haven't had the chance to meet with other tribes as quite as much as Nadja has, but yeah, at least within the Northwest I have.
Yeah, and then last but not least, I'm thinking, Ms. Johnson, about the point that you made about this not coming up maybe quite as much, but then I think about the fact that we know that, for example, if you think about Pacific Islanders, even the individual cultures there can be quite different from each other in terms of health beliefs. I know I've had times when in my medical practice I've had people from a lot of different Southeast Asian nations, and their traditions around health issues are very different. I would have to believe, although I completely profess to my lack of deep knowledge, that the same could be true among tribes. And I wonder about, and I'm sure going to be getting into this a little bit, but providing culturally appropriate care based on knowledge and whether we have resources for healthcare providers who want to be thoughtful about providing culturally appropriate healthcare based on traditional belief structures, which are important to value.
I appreciate that, because I believe that is very important. One area I can mention quickly is that some of the tribes in Oregon are very interested in learning more about traditional health workers and how they can support their communities, especially as like peer support specialists, peer wellness coaches, even doulas. Great. We've talked a lot about you know, those traditional practices. So,
thank you. Senator Winters.
A question, and knowing that in Oregon, the creation of the Indian Commission in 1975 has assisted in cementing the government-to-government relationships in Oregon, how many other states actually have, you know, the same kind of commission that we're fortunate and blessed to have had? Governor Atiyah began, and he's not with us, but I know that he started it in he pushed for the legislation in 1975. So are other states similar to what we're doing?
With your permission, Senator, I know that Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, New York, Florida, and the state of Washington all have similar commissions or boards that respond to the tribes and are in that in-between of policy and practice between their state and the tribes within their states. But we are cutting edge on some of our practice, it's true.
Good to hear. Thank you both for all those answers.
Thank you. Next slide, please. The Tribal Affairs Unit that is within the Director's Office is at the request of tribes and the values of the current director and previous directors. I'm a direct report, and what that means is that a tribal council member can call me and relay a message of concern directly to the director. Knowing that we have that direct link of communication really allows for a more enriched conversation and transparency of services, avoiding what could be an impasse in conversation. Knowing that we have the ear of the director is a value that the tribes have repeatedly told me. It's really important that Clyde knows how it's going, that Clyde understands some of our dilemmas in both child welfare and serving people with aging and people with disabilities. I'm fortunate in that how I was raised on a little Indian reservation in upstate New York, and my father taught me immediately, my very first term in fourth grade was the federal trust responsibility, which I think is a little unusual for children. And he maintained throughout my education as a child and as a young person in his family that it's not a custodian-ward relationship. It's a government-to-government relationship. And so I have that as a value in working with tribes. I see a mutuality of need and a mutuality of resources that we can provide. I know that having three children is something that I'm very proud of. I have two children that are enrolled in an Oregon tribe, they're Cayuse, and one son who's a veteran who's an enrolled Comanche. And so I'm recognizing that I have an intrinsic, inherent principle of wanting to do the best for tribal children is actually at work and at home. The slide that is up right now is specific to how 42 years of relationship between the state of Oregon and tribes can be compressed into a very short timeline. I'm going to focus on the highlighted yellow portions, and ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, directs specific activity to occur between a child welfare placing agency, a state court, and tribes. And that is something that from 1978 has been my profession. I have an advanced degree in the administration and policy of the Indian Child Welfare Act, and I understand that the policy implications at times need to be supported by improved procedural manual. And I direct staff within the unit to have a very specific focus on the individual relationships between the branches and the tribes and the families. We're on the road a lot, and I know that it's because of that relationship building that we've been able to create ICWA agreements. We've been able to avoid what I've already cited as impasse. We've not ever had a case go to the appellate court since I've been the director that has put in opposition a tribe in Oregon and the state of Oregon. And that's on purpose. We make a point to gather as much information, as much procedural behavior as possible, and then have that conversation with the tribe on what we could have done better, what we did well, and how we can improve the relationship. We actually have what we define as a de-escalation path. It's not an escalation path, it's a de-escalation path. How do we inform the districts to the director, to the deputy director of some of the cases in Indian child welfare that could indeed require that level of focus? In 2013, there was a policy option package that you funded specific to active efforts. We now have 9 active effort positions across the state that respond directly to the needs of being ICWA compliant. And those positions are fully seated. They have my influence, not my authority. They have their own supervisors from their own branches, but it's a part of that relationship building between the tribes and us that I think is really valuable. Next slide, please. One of the things that drives our work is understanding that we have series of program areas that we try to provide the resources, the technical assistance, and the linkage. If a family was to come into tribal affairs, which they do, they email, they call. I don't have a desk line. I actually have only a cell phone, and that's on purpose. And they'll reach out. I need my child to seek treatment, and we'll be able to get a topical expert to provide that information and linkage. We have a federal boarding school in the city of Salem, and I've actually been called on to help with trying to untangle a case for a child who was vulnerable. Excuse me. One of our primary functions, I think, in behavior of the unit and what we really work hard at is translating the values of the state government to the tribe and then translating the values of the tribe back to state government.
Thank you. Senator Winters?
Just because you raised the question of the involvement, of individuals that are not a part of the 9 tribes here in Oregon, and the boarding school is actually one of those. And you might want to put a little more context on the boarding school that's here at Chemawa.
Yes, ma'am. So in the early 1900s, there was federal policy that was grounded on the belief of the federal government that a person could have their culture killed and remain someone who could be built as a human. That is the language from Colonel Pratt. And in that perspective, a number of federal boarding schools were funded through the Department of Interior. I myself went to boarding school. My parents went to boarding school. I was pressed to not send my teenage boy to boarding school, and I'm a better parent because of it. There is one remaining boarding school in Oregon, and that is at Chemawa. And Chemawa and having that influx of out-of-state children puts them in a very special position. They're on federal trust land, but they come from other states, and the boarding school is essentially their custodian. And so recognizing that we've done away with the paradigm of killing the culture, and we are left with a system of education that in part fulfills the federal trust responsibility. The federal trust responsibility is grounded on the belief that the government will provide for the health, education, and welfare of federally recognized tribes. and that it's a government-to-government relationship. Was that adequate, ma'am?
That was very well stated. Thank you.
Thank you for asking that question, Senator. Thank you, Ms. Jones. Very helpful.
Next slide, please. The Indian Child Welfare Act has been a law since 1978, and I know that a part of our effort within the Tribal Affairs Unit is uniquely driven to compliance with this law. It's only been in the last 2 years that the Department of Interior has issued guidelines and regulations that the state of Oregon has been able to promulgate into rule. We've had extraordinary support from internal DHS leadership within the child welfare program areas and the districts and leadership in, within the executive department for this rule to be made. We filed on February 7th, and we are in the process now of refining our procedural manual. We have two ICWA consultants, Christine Camps and Emily Hawkins, and an executive support person, Kristen Potts. We know that within our four, we're able to manage and coordinate efforts across the state for better ICWA compliance. I know that we took it upon ourselves 2 years ago to do an individual hand count. Our information systems don't always capture everything that we want it to capture. And the ICWA liaisons and myself built a hand count protocol that we went to every branch, to every district, to every office, and they provided a hand count of Indian children. And one of the very best things that it produced was we validated that we have a 3-to-1 ratio of out-of-state tribal children in our care. That the internal 9 tribes of Oregon have only a third of our caseload, and the other 2/3 are out-of-state tribal children. And so that's the level of outreach that we need to maintain consistently for out-of-state tribes. There are tribes that significantly appear in court more, the Navajo Nation, the Cherokee Nation, and then there are tribes that through capacity shortages, we need to reach out more. We need to provide that information more on the ongoing process of their court and their children in our care. Next slide, please. One of the accomplishments that I want to bring our attention to is that for the very first time, we have ICWA agreements with the Klamath Tribe, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indians Reservation, and the Cow Creek Tribe. We had never had those agreements before, and our ICWA agreements are actually better case practice than the federal statute. And there's no money in those agreements that's exchanged. It's all based on the value of us understanding when a child comes into our care, we agree to do this and you agree to do this. You agree to do this, we agree to do that. So there's genuine transparency in the process, and we train regularly on ICWA agreements to each of the individual tribes in their communities at their request. I was specifically asked to bring forward some of the information on training and outreach to tribal communities, and I want to tell you that it's a value for the tribe to keep their children safe. And at their request, we have collaborated multiple times with tribes to provide mandatory reporting in their community to staff, to family. We bring our Oregon statute on child safety. We are provided with the tribe's code on child safety, and we train entire communities on this is a mandatory reporter, this is what you're looking for, this is child abuse, this is child neglect, this is who to call. We also rely on national partners. The National Indian Child Welfare Association is a well-respected, multi-decade organization that has provided and developed curricula that we then adapt at their approval for tribal youth here in Oregon. One of the things that I want to, as a point of pride for the work that the state has done with tribes, is we had a community along the Columbia River, the Celilo Village, and the Celilo Village is what I've been informed by my elders as the sole source of all the language and the stories and the ceremonies for the river tribes. that in that longhouse, that's when the creation story started, that's when ceremonies are incepted, and knowing that we had a real grave disparity of services, I got support from Director Psyche and from the district, and we were able to collaborate with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. They're the agency that oversees the maintenance of the enlucites to serve families that are fishing salmon out of the Columbia River as treaty tribes. And we worked alongside with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Oregon Food Bank, and we were able to bring services and equity to 108 families along the river in the last 2 years. It's one of our accomplishments that the tribal families can now count on us. In the winter, we're going to bring coats, and in the summer, we bring school supplies. And the building that had previously been empty is now used every other week for an Oregon Food Bank distribution site. And people that live along the river and very basic necessity needs come up and they become eligible for SNAP. They become eligible for services to the elderly. And I'm very proud of that. I think that's good work that we're doing for the tribes. One of the ways that we hold ourselves accountable to the services and the resources we provide to tribes is through the Legislative Commission on Indian Services Government-to-Government Report. When I first started, that report was 66 pages long, and I did an analysis of that report, and with that director's approval, we condensed that report to answering key questions. How well are we providing this service within the program area? What gaps have emerged as we're providing this service, and where can we do better? And we collect that information every year. It's provided to the Legislative Commission by December 5th of each year. All five program areas respond to those questions. And Director Psyche has been very clear that those questions will be used to analyze our next year's work. Those questions, when they're answered, have us recognize in APD we could be doing better. In serving people with developmental disabilities, we could be doing better. And that then drives our focus for the next year. If you'd like a copy of that, I'd be happy to send that to the group. And it has been an honor and a privilege to be here for you guys today, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any.
We really appreciate this presentation, Ms. Jones. Ms. Johnson, are there parts that you're going to add now? Or?
Yes.
Okay, great. It's all yours.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Ms. Jones. Really appreciate it.
Thank you again for the time. It is great to be here today.
And normally we have to ask people to sit back from the mic.
Sorry.
No. Can you actually pull yours a little closer to you? Because you've got a softer voice and want to make sure that you get on the record. Thank you so much.
I really see the vision of
tribal. And I'm sorry to interrupt you one more time. Have you introduced yourself for the record yet?
Oh.
I apologize. I don't remember if you did or not.
I believe I did, but
okay.
I will. Again,
cool.
My name is Julie Johnson, and I'm the Interim Tribal Affairs Director for the Oregon Health Authority. It is a great pleasure to be here and work alongside my colleague, Nadja Jones. I've known her for a number of years, and I really honor and respect her and her hard work that she does, and it's great to have that partnership. I see our vision in tribal affairs for the Oregon Health Authority that our Native people of Oregon will be healthy physically, emotionally, spiritually, and mentally. I believe in those values. As Nadja shared how she was raised, I was raised with those values as well. And everything that I've learned through working with the tribes over my career has instilled those values in me. I see our mission in tribal affairs for the Oregon Health Authority, again, is working across the division, overseeing all of those very important programs that are serving our Native American people. This is an organizational chart at a very high level of the Oregon Health Authority, and again, it shows that this position is a direct report to our director, Lynn Saxton, how important that is, and the responsibility of working across the seven divisions in anything that is related to our Native American people. Go ahead. I wanted to highlight a couple areas that we're currently working on with the tribes. For Health Systems Division, which is one of our largest divisions, is where the Oregon Health Plan sits. And so providing the data for the members in the Oregon Health Plan, I'm going to have another slide about that. But again, for our Heritage Native American members that are enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan, making sure that they're receiving the services that they need. Of course, we have the open card fee-for-service population and then the managed care population. I have some data on that in the next couple slides. Another area that we're working on is care coordination for our fee-for-service population, because they don't receive the same services as in a managed care organization, a CCO. We still want to make sure that they are getting care coordination, so that's one of the big projects we're working on right now is for our fee-for-service members. 100% FMAP is the federal match for services provided in an Indian Health Services or tribal or urban Indian clinic. The savings that the state of Oregon will receive from the federal government will come back to the state and be provided to the tribes to support their health system. This is a new program that the tribes have been working very hard on along with our partners at OHA, and we're excited to see those savings come back and support our tribes in our health care system. And then also our alcohol and drug programs and mental health programs that are also part of Health Systems Division. Currently, we have 7 tribes that are funded for alcohol and drug programs, and all 9 tribes are funded for the new mental health investments. This was a great accomplishment for the Oregon Health Authority because 3 of our tribes have never had mental health programs before. We understand how historical trauma and intergenerational trauma still affects our people today. And so having the opportunity for tribes to look at their needs of mental health and try to start building a program to address those needs has been a really great impact on tribes. We've also been working as the new part of Health Transformation 2.0 with the Behavioral Health Collaborative, that the tribes have their own process on making recommendations of the best services for their tribal people. In public health, we fund tribes on a number of different areas. Oh, I'm sorry, I did want to mention that we do have 1 full-time FTE as the health system's tribal health liaison. This is a really great key position that assists me because of their background around Medicaid and everything, the very complex system of Medicaid. So I did want to mention, I had said in a past meeting that, you know, in tribal affairs, I am the only person currently working in this tribal affairs director position. I do have support staff, really great support staff, but we do have 4 other full-time positions within the agency working on tribal issues, and I really look to them for their help and work and support to work with all the other agency staff. So in public health division, we have 2 FTEs for doing the tribal work. One is under emergency preparedness, and the other one is in health promotion chronic disease prevention. That's my regular role, as I'm doing this interim role. We provide funding for all 9 tribes for emergency preparedness services and for different areas of prevention, focusing on substance abuse prevention and also tobacco prevention. And we fund 1 tribe for a healthy communities grant. The tribes have a lot of health disparities when we're looking at data around diabetes, heart disease, obesity, substance abuse, and so working in the areas of chronic disease prevention, these are some of the ways that we can address some of those issues. Tribes have very strong programs, and some of those programs are the backbone of their communities because, again, they're built on their strengths and their culture, and it involves the community at that very ground level, and I believe that's really where they're going to make the difference. Also, maternal child health funds tribes, not all tribes, but a number of the tribes in some of the work that they do, and then the immunization program also funds a couple of the tribes. Health policy and analytics helps us with our data for our H&A data for the OHP. They've also been very tremendously helpful with the 1115 demonstration waiver that we've been working on. We've had a special work group with tribes for their tribal engagement and collaboration protocol, working with our Medicaid director, Lori Koiner, and her team, and with assistance from the Northwest Portland Area and Health Board, working alongside with the tribes. They have come up with a great addendum to that waiver, and it's going to be really good moving forward. I believe a draft has gone to CMS, and we're just finalizing some pieces to that. The other division areas, we do a little bit of work. We do have a tribal liaison at the state hospital, which is really important to serve our patients that are there. They make sure that they're receiving their culturally relevant services. And then, of course, in external relations, and getting to work more with the Office of Equity and Inclusion. I'm looking forward to working with Leanne more and her team around the traditional health workers aspect that I mentioned earlier, that's very important for the tribes. So that's just some of the areas that we're currently working on right now for projects within OHA and the tribes. I just wanted to talk real quickly about communication and consultation with the tribes. Nadja and I have both spoke about the importance of the relationship and honor and respect, but it's important to understand what consultation is. And we actually just had a joint consultation earlier this week on a very important subject that affects all of our tribal people and affects both agencies. And so that's really about inviting the tribes at an early time to have enough time to be provided all of the information needed and have questions answered and documents provided to them to make the best decision that they need to that's going to affect their tribes. We invite tribal leadership, and that can vary from tribe to tribe. It could mean tribal council members, or it could be a designated staff like a health director.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Senator Winters.
Thank you. And healthcare, I'm going to leap to healthcare disparities because they tend to be real huge variables when we look at the various populations. What are you doing in order to actually bridge those gaps? And I'm thinking specifically because of the issue of distrust by research, not only for Native Americans, but also for African Americans and others. Often they're not a part of the trials. Are you working at all on that particular issue? To educate so that we do become a part of some of those trials, so when we talk about disease management and pharmaceuticals, that actually they're relevant to our physiological body.
It's
a huge issue.
It is a huge issue, and I appreciate that question and bringing that up. Every time I see data for Native Americans and you see those huge health disparities, it always just breaks our heart, and this is why we're here. This is why we do the work that we do. I believe, again, that the tribes have the knowledge and strength to help bridge some of those gaps, and it's our job to support them in that work. Some of the tribes have very strong, like, diabetes prevention programs, substance abuse prevention programs. I think addressing, obesity and all of the risk factors that affect those different health diseases is really where we need to support the tribes in working on, at the same time while providing the health care that they need. So I believe that it's woven into all of the work that we do, but I don't have a really great example of it besides just supporting the tribes in the work that we're already doing.
Thank you.
I think I was thinking in terms of getting some of the research labs and what have you, NIH, in order to begin to do some of the work. And I'll tell you one in specific. I know that they were doing it in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and among the Choctaw women with respect to dystrophic calcification and some of those issues that tend to be more prevalent among that population. And, mine is encouraging NIH and some of the others to begin doing a lot more research so that we can know actually what works as far as prescriptions and what have you.
I have a part of the information if you'd like to hear it, ma'am.
Yes.
So at OHSU, they have a center called the One Sky Center, and that's specifically to research and provide program information on how to serve people affected by methamphetamine. And that in trying to do that, we've actually created a center of research and resources that a tribe, knowing that we've had such an epidemic of methamphetamine in our communities, tribes voluntarily shared their data so that we could improve policy, so we could improve some of the funding streams directly toward tribes. And I know that tribes in Oregon have actually benefited from that One Sky Center.
Thanks.
Here's just some data that I wanted to share with you from the Oregon Health Plan. The one thing that I wanted to point out, again, as I talked about our fee-for-service population versus our managed care, because Indian people have the option to choose which of those they would like, it currently sits at about 50% each. Again, that's one reason why we're working on the fee-for-service care coordination agreements that will support our tribes in that area. Currently, we have about 34,000 total HNA people enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. This has a breakdown of the age and gender as well. Okay, good. I too wanted to talk a little bit about the trainings aspects that the Oregon Health Authority provides. Again, it is a requirement of Senate Bill 770 to train state staff on how to be working best with tribes. I currently have a presentation that I do with new employees when they come on board as a part of the public health new employee orientation and also the OHA new employee orientation. As sections of the division request me to do the presentation, I have done that. And I have actually done two presentations yesterday, and I have one scheduled for today. So my current number of 145 will increase by about 30 this week. So it's kind of a, you know, I'm not reaching a lot of people at this point, but people are really learning a lot from this training, and I have a lot of great feedback. The one point that I wanted to share with you that we've been working on collaborating with DHS and Department of Education and the Oregon Youth Authority is that our four tribal liaisons in those areas are working on an online training of working with tribal governments, and we're working with the Legislative Commission on Indian Services to help us with the information and the tribes to provide us that history and important work that needs to be done to share with all of our state colleagues. So that will be hopefully, we're shooting for a deadline to have a draft of that in December. It'll be provided, once it's all finished and finalized, it'll be provided on the iLearn system, but we'll be able to reach many more staff, and it will be a requirement. Our directors have made it a requirement to reach managers and staff that are going to be working with tribes.
That's great. Thank you. Representative Alonso Leon.
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair. I just wanted to say that I think this is fabulous work that you're doing to do training across different agencies. I'd love for this training to go beyond these agencies because I see some agencies missing here. And I think it is, if we have the expertise already, instead of bringing people on board, we should have you guys do more training across other agencies that work with our across the state with our population. So I just want to say kudos, and I look forward to seeing other agencies asking you to go out and do presentations.
Thank you. That's one thing I really enjoy.
I think it makes a lot of sense not to reinvent the wheel. I mean, there may be some different kinds of things that you need to make clear, you know, because different people will be interacting with tribal members in different contexts, but there are some core principles about cultural awareness and questions and things people need to be aware of that are communal, and there's no need to reinvent the wheel across agencies. So that's a great point, Representative.
Absolutely.
It's also been requested of the tribes for hopefully to get that training out to our CCOs as well. So
perfect.
That'll be great. Go ahead. I just wanted to mention very quickly some of our partners that we work with alongside with the tribes. I've mentioned the Northwest Portland Area and Health Board a couple of times. Their organization serves the 43 tribes in Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. They're a key partner because the tribes know them and respect them and work with them, trust them on a regular basis. And so our work with them is very important as well. Going back to health promotion, chronic disease prevention, they have a number of prevention programs that they support, culturally relevant services to tribes. They also have an epicenter, and so we've done some data crosswalking to make sure that records are correct if people are being, misregistered in a data system as the wrong race and ethnicity. They can crosswalk those data systems to double check and see if they are actually Native American people, and that's really important as well. NARA is an urban Indian health center. They receive funding from the Indian Health Services, so where they're not a tribe, they are a very important partner in the work that we do. Again, we also fund them for alcohol and drug and mental health services. And then NAYA, the Native American Youth Association, is a community-based organization that is serving that large population of Native people in the urban areas of Portland metro area. The last slide I wanted to leave you with was just a couple resources. Again, we really thank you for your time today and allowing us to share with you. The Legislative Commission on Indian Services, of course, is a great website. There's links to all of the tribes. If you're ever interested, you can go there and click on any of the links to the tribes for more information if you're wondering about a specific tribe. Also, all of the annual reports that we both talked about are there, and the contact lists for the cluster meetings are also there. There's a new video that just came out by OPB that was done in April, or that came out in April. It honors all 9 tribes of Oregon and their history. It's called Broken Treaty. And I recommend that you watch it if you do have about an hour to spare, because it really shows our current leadership and how the history of Oregon has affected our tribal people. And we're working with OPB to use some video clips in this online training that we're going to be doing. So that's an exciting piece. So any other questions?
Thank you so much. And Ms. Johnson, I'm officially only speaking for myself, although I think the rest of the community, I hope we're going to be hearing soon that you're no longer the interim director, the director and permanent, because I have to say personally I've been extraordinarily impressed by your presentations here and the work that you've been doing. So I hope we're going to be hearing soon that you're officially in this position.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any other questions for this panel? Great.
Not a question, but I do have a comment, because I've been around and I've seen the changes in child welfare. It's very rewarding to hear of all the work that is being done, the positive work that's being done, because there was a time when the state actually had no involvement with the recognized tribes. In fact, I had a project at Warm Springs because there was a tremendous distrust between the tribes and the states, state operation. And so it makes me pleased to see all the changes that have occurred that are positive changes. So I want to thank both of you.
It's an honor and a privilege.
Thank you both very, very much. Excellent presentation and very informative. Okay, next up.
Thank you, co-chairs. We're going to move to the equity and inclusion presentations.
Thank you, Dr. Richardson. Ladies.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lydia Muñiz, and I am the Director of the Office of Equity and Multicultural Services for the Department of Human Services. First of all, I want to express my gratitude, my appreciation for your time and your interest in hearing about the wonderful work across both of our agencies. And I'm very pleased to be sharing the table with my counterpart, Leanne, and she will follow up with her presentation. But we do have many, many occasions where we do share projects, share resources. I consider myself very fortunate to have a counterpart that I can also rely on and brainstorm different ideas across agencies. So I wanted to acknowledge that. So if we go to our first slide, you might recall this from Dr. Richardson's presentation a couple of weeks ago, where he offered this graphic of the DHS office, community office. And I thought that this was important because in red you will see our office identified, and I thought it was a good visual in that it really represents where we sit within the organization. We are part of the director's office with direct report to the deputy director, Dr. Richardson. And if you recall the analogy that we shared with you a couple of weeks ago, is there are some foundational programs that help support all of the different roles of the different programs within the agency. And that is one of the roles that our office serves. We are a foundation of the structure of the agency and have interaction across the agency with the different programs. Our mission is really about empowering the agency and helping guide and lead so that we integrate diversity, inclusion, equity into everything that the agency does. Just a brief history about the office. Dr. Richardson shared with you sort of the, how the office was first instituted. And so it was with the split of the two agencies when the Oregon Health Authority became its own agency and DHS became its, set of different programs and agency. The Department of Human Services chose to, at that point, form the Office of Equity and Multicultural Services to have it really focus on the programs of the agency and then allow OHA to focus on its programs as well. In 2011, when the agencies were split, we started with a staff of four staff members, and over the years, we have been able to add additional staff members to address some of the work of the agency, and we are currently at a staff of 10. To go over a little bit about the major areas of responsibility, I've sort of grouped it into three groups, and so I'll go over some of that work. We have one of the areas is diversity and inclusion development, and this is an internal focus. So it is about our building staff skills and an inclusive work environment. So it's the work that we do internally within DHS. Number two, we have service equity identified as an area of work that we also do across the agency. This would be where our external focus is, and it really is about access and outcomes to the communities and clients that we serve. And within that umbrella of service equity, we have two other major efforts. One is our race, ethnicity, and language plus disability effort, which looks to standardize the collection of demographic data for our clients so that we are better able to target and focus on the areas of need depending on our client needs. And then we also have language access services. And again, that is focusing externally on the needs of our clients to make sure that we are keeping up and informed about the needs of our clients so that we can provide those services. The third umbrella, if you will, really is under the umbrella of civil rights. And that includes equal employment opportunity, which is about preventing or ending discrimination in employment. It's about affirmative action, which is achieving a diverse workforce. So that's sort of an internal look. And then we also have the Americans with Disabilities Act function currently within our office. And that is a position that is responsible for Title I and Title II for the agency. And so those all fall under the rubric of civil rights, if you will. So how do we do the work? So you have up on the slide a graphic. And at DHS, we established a service equity framework, which is really about outlining six very distinct, but I think very complementary principle and approaches for how we conduct our business within the agency and externally of how we provide services to our clients. And if we go to the next slide, we also have, I love this visual, this graphic, and it is used widely within our organization, and you probably have seen it in other forms and formats. But for us, this is what service equity is, and this is really where we have been focusing a lot of our efforts and our attention. If you look at one side of the graphic, it really shows sort of a one-size-fits-all. It's equal. Everybody gets the same thing. And so we know that that doesn't always work. And so what we are really trying to focus on and move towards is really the other side of the graphic, which is about equity. And it really is about customizing the needs of the client and being responsive to those needs in the work and how we deliver that that service. So I wanted to share that graphic with you. We've also identified a list of priorities for our 2017-19 biennium, and you can see a list there. For today's conversation, I'd really like to focus again on our service equity. One of the things at the agency that we have sort of all, everybody on deck, we've decided that we really want to focus on our service equity strategic initiative. So every program, everyone within the department is aware of this initiative. We are focusing on the principle of community engagement to start with. So all hands on deck, we're going to work on really creating those relationships, maintaining that transparency between the clients that we serve and the programs, what we do and how we do it. And it really is about getting out into the communities, talking about our work and getting feedback. So a concept of not going and offering this is what we know you need or what we believe you need, but rather asking, here's what we provide. How does that serve you? Is that meeting your need, or how do we need to adjust that in order to meet the needs of our clients? So as a result of this focus on service equity as a strategic initiative, we know from getting some feedback and doing some work already within our communities that one of the high needs is linguistically specific services. And so,
Lydia, I'd like to go back a little bit, because there's some areas and it's nothing new for me to talk about this, of the huge disparities, particularly which in child welfare and the length of stay, that the minorities much longer stay in the system. And this has been, you know, one that I have tried to point out to the agency for years. The question is why the population, the minority population, tends to remain in the system much longer, and what is the agency doing to correct those? So when you talk about community engagement, can you be a little more specific as to what you are doing to address that particular issue? I brought it before when Erin Carolee Seals was director, and I don't think that there's been much of a change since. And the question still remains, why is it because we don't have enough foster parents? Is it because what is really, and is your agency, is your department really involved in that, this particular issue?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, did you want to address that, or do you want me to go ahead? All right. So, Senator Winters, you pointed out that this has been a conversation over the years. And so part of the work that we do, especially as we start to focus in on the community engagement, is we're going to be working with each specific program. And what we are currently doing right now is we've asked each of the program areas to do an assessment within their programs of what they need in terms of having us be a resource for them in the community engagement. So we know that foster homes are an issue. That is one of the things that is on our list of things to go out to community, talk about, to try and recruit linguistically and culturally specific homes so that we have more to offer. That is an ongoing initiative, and to say that we will be working with each of the programs to identify their specific need within their program, that we can be a resource and help them engage with those communities.
Senator Gilson. Thank you, Madam Chair. How does deafness and ASL or captioning fit into the definition of linguistically appropriate?
So, co-chairs and Senator Gelter, so I do have a slide where I'm going to talk about it. Would you want me to address it now, or can...
No, I can wait, but just a quick follow-up on the specific question, on the foster care question. Uh-huh. I've heard from within the DD community concerns about individuals that experience intellectual and developmental disability that are also deaf, that the challenge of finding foster homes where that individual can actually communicate with the people with whom they live to receive care. Is that part of that recruitment as well?
So, Senator Senator Gelzer. So to your question, so part of the issue is it does fall under our language access services in making sure that staff have adequate tools and varied tools in order to address whatever the linguistic need might be. So ASL and services to deaf and hard of hearing communities falls under that. But as you are aware also, and you indicated, there is another section within our program, Adults and People with Disabilities, that also has a part of that role in addressing as needs come in to find those interpreters for the clients that need that. So it's a dual role.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And just a quick follow-up. So I assume when looking for, you know, kind of in the foster care piece, looking for families that speak Spanish or speak Russian mm-hmm. or speak Korean, whatever the language is that the child or adult might need, I guess the question is more, is there recruitment among among deaf families to be providing direct care so that there's not an interpreter between the individual providing care and the individual and that linguistically, I mean, not being able to communicate is a pretty significant barrier.
Absolutely. Senator Gelzer, so thank you for that follow-up. So there are efforts in place, and we are working, again, with our program, so specifically with our DD program and APD to get a better handle on what specifically they need in that environment and how we can be a resource as well to respond to some of those needs. Thank you.
And Ms. Muniz, I'm very sorry to have to do this, but I'm going to ask you to wrap up in about 5 minutes so Ms. Johnson
okay.
can get some time as well.
Very good.
And then we can always bring you guys back later in session if we feel like we haven't had a chance to address all of these issues
Thank you. All right.
Thank you very much.
So let's move on to the next slide then.
Great. Thank you.
One of the other, I think, sort of signature models that we have at DHS is that we recognize that our workforce is a critical part of service delivery. And so one of the things that we've done is to form create some employee resource groups. So on the slide there, you have the six listed, and these are intended to uphold the mission and the goals of the agency, as well as give employees an opportunity to engage within their groups, their interest areas, and identify either workplace or community needs that they can help the agency close some of the gaps in. It is considered a best practice, and it is always mission-driven towards the goals of the agency. So next slide. One of the other things that we also do is that we help train staff as well as partners across different agencies. That came up in the previous presentation about, you know, how to share some of that training across other agencies. And we have had requests to do that, and we will offer ourselves as a resource to other agencies when that need comes up. We have a variety of training courses. One is our, you know, our signature PAWSE training course within the Department of Human Services. We've trained over 3,900 plus staff and other partners across agencies. We have a number that are ongoing, several trainings that are customized to the need of either different programs or different populations. So depending on the need, we can be very agile and flexible in terms of how we present that. All right. Thank you, Dr. Richardson. So we're going to go ahead and move on, and I'd be happy to come back and share any information with you. Again, I appreciate your time, your interest. I'm going to turn it over to my counterpart and let her have an opportunity to also share with you on the Oregon Health Authority. So, Leanne Johnson.
Thank you, Ms. Muniz, and I'm very sorry that we have to cut you a little short. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you very much, co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record. My name is Leanne Johnson, and I am the Director of the Equity and Inclusion Division for the Oregon Health Authority. And I would like to just echo the good feelings shared by my colleagues about the opportunity to be here, first of all, and the fact that we have the opportunity to work together across agency on these very important critical issues. So, next slide, please. You've already seen this from Ms. Johnson, This is our organizational chart, and you can see that the Equity and Inclusion Division, also known as the Office of Equity and Inclusion, is indeed one of the seven divisions of the Oregon Health Authority. My position reports directly to our director, and that indicates very clearly the priority this holds within the agency, and also the fact that health equity is one of our six primary values of the Oregon Health Authority, and our role in that is to enact that espoused value to make sure that we operationalize what we mean when we say that health equity is indeed a value. The next slide will show you a brief timeline of how we have evolved as a program within the Oregon Health Authority. Our program actually started in 1993, quite some time ago, as the Office of Multicultural Health and Services. And basically, the program focused around minority health in particular, and it was located in public health, and many states will have what's called a minority health officer. So basically, that function over time has evolved to become our office and the full set of work and initiatives that we provide. We were moved into the director's office several years ago when we were DHS, and then you heard about the split between the two agencies that occurred in 2011 officially. We then, at that point in 2012, became the Office of Equity and Inclusion and broadened our scope beyond minority health. And then in 2015, under Director Saxton, we are indeed a division of the Oregon Health Authority at this point in time. Next slide, please. You can see that the functions, these are the primary functions of the work that our division does, not only within the agency, but across the health delivery system, across the health system for the state of Oregon. We have a regulatory function. I will talk a bit about that. We also provide technical assistance to our internal agency, as well as to coordinated care organizations and across the health delivery system, including public health. And that piece is very critical because our role is to be consultants and to be proactive and address issues before they arise. Very specifically, our work has been also focused around policy development, best practice policy, and then the implementation of that policy. So you can see that we have two primary buckets of work: health equity. That encompasses about 75% of our work and our resources, and the primary work there is closing the avoidable health gaps that do indeed exist within the health system, and then also within our populations, I should say, and then also workforce development. So we have an internal focus as well regarding diversity, inclusion, equal employment opportunity, civil rights, and that's about 20% of our work within, and that's within the specific Oregon Health Authority agency. Going to the next slide, please. You'll see some of our primary health equity work highlighted here, and I would like to just run through those if I could. I will try to be brief, but these are some primary areas of work. It's where policy and program meet. So cultural competency continuing education, that actually came forward in legislation in 2013. That focuses primarily on the 22 health licensing boards. And so what we are doing is helping to develop and approve curriculum for licensing around cultural competency within the practice for practitioners. Traditional health worker certification, we are creating a registry of traditional health workers that work across the health system that is getting a lot of attention currently around doulas in particular. And our work has been to qualify and certify and create a registry so that traditional health workers can become integrated into the care team, addressing very specifically culturally specific appropriate services, appropriate care, and also addressing the social determinants of health, because health is holistic. We take a holistic look at that. Healthcare interpreters, we want to make sure that a healthcare interpreter that's brought into a care setting is both proficient in the language and also in medical terms. So we qualify and certify healthcare interpreters under those two primary domains. Implementation of the race, ethnicity, language, disability, demographic data. Ms. Muniz already talked about that, so I won't go into detail, but that is definitely a piece of legislation that came forward and also work that we do across both of our agencies. Another really critical piece of work that we carry out is to review bills that come to the Oregon Health Authority. And we currently have reviewed close to 90 bills. And what we do is we review for a health equity lens, with the health equity lens. And we are looking both for unintended consequences that may impact specific communities, as well as how can we strengthen the bill so that we are addressing health disparities across all social determinants of health, not just in healthcare delivery. Regional health equity coalitions, we have six of those throughout the state, and the focus there is to identify regional issues and regional solutions. We are a very, very diverse state, as you know, urban, rural, many demographics of people and populations of people, and one size does not fit all. So the regional health equity coalitions really work regionally to determine what are the burning issues within their counties and within their cities and regions, and they address those issues locally. Yes, Senator?
It does make me wonder how much collaboration there is between those coalitions and the CCO community advisory boards, which develop community health improvement plans, where clearly some of the health equity issues play an important role.
Mm-hmm. And so, yes, there is collaboration and exists at varying levels depending upon the CAC and depending upon the coalition. But, for example, in the Hood River area, Wasco County area, there is a very direct connection between the CAC, the Community Advisory Council, and the work that's being done there. So it is an opportunity, and it's one of those situations where we have a lot more work to do and a lot more opportunity that we can pursue in that area.
Do you believe that that's something you can do with your existing capabilities, or do you need more legislative direction to support you in making those collaborations happen more effectively?
I think we could always use more legislation that helps to provide more authority for that work to be regulated, for it to be required. At this stage of our development as a state, we have people that are working, functioning very specifically for the good of the cause, and to have more of a roadmap that will help direct us as to where we put our resources and where we put our priorities is very helpful to us and to this work.
Would you be kind enough to send an email to Ms. Ames about some of your thoughts about how that might be the most helpful? We may have some opportunities to make some statutory changes this session that might assist you in those efforts.
Absolutely.
But we'd need a little guidance from you about what you think would be the most helpful.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Alonso.
Chair, you brought up a brilliant question that I think is really important for all of our agencies that are doing this level of work, that and for us to better support you, we need to know from your perspective how we can support you legislatively. And so, you know, potentially in the future, creating new bills that will support your work and make it possible for there to be better collaboration across the state, I think, is really important for us, and we want to help you. Thank you for that.
Ms. Johnson,
Thank you. The next area is our Delta training program, Developing Equity Leadership Through Training and Action, and that program is very specific it's a 9-month cohort, and it includes people from coordinated care organizations, providers, clinicians, and community-based organizations, and they go through a 9-month program to deepen their knowledge around health equity and how health equity can become more than just a value, how it really can become a practice within those various domains that I mentioned. So that's an area that is providing an opportunity to build broader capacity throughout the state. Non-discrimination for the public, that's an OAR, and that work has been completed fairly recently, and we provide not only consultation to coordinated care organizations and to the community, but also if there's a need to investigate any matters that may come forward, our office also does that. And then also community engagement is a very critical piece of the work we do. Community wisdom is imperative. Nothing about the community without the community is very important to how we do our work. And with so many ways that we could be doing our work, it's really important to connect with the community. So we are prioritizing and prioritizing what they feel is most important and what's going to have the greatest impact given limited time and limited resources. So that wraps up our health equity work. I'm going to backtrack just ever so briefly with this circle here, and this really speaks to the fact that we do have created a policy platform. That policy platform was completed in July of 2014, and you can see throughout that, I won't go through each of these areas, but what you can see are all the areas where we have created. Our office has created policy that impacts not only the Oregon Health Authority, but also in the broader health system and public health, and that would include some of the areas that have already been mentioned, such as language access, bilingual proficiency, civil rights, diversity recruitment, employee resource groups. All of those are best practices, and you can see that across both agencies, we have both adopted best practice, and we share ideas and at times work together very specifically to share charters and policy and procedural language. So moving to the next slide, we've already spoken about health equity and health inequities, but just want to underscore the fact that this goes beyond whether someone chooses to eat an apple or a candy bar. When we talk about persistent and pervasive health issues, especially related to specific populations within our state, we're talking about generations of overoppression and a legacy of policy that has unfortunately disadvantaged many populations, not only within our state, but also within our country. So our work is really at that very foundational level, and it's why policy is so very critical, because we're trying to right the ship, if you will, that was headed down one pathway that wasn't working for everybody, and we want to make this work for all people for the state of Oregon.
And I should say that Ms. Johnson and I both had the privilege of attending a conference, a national conference that happened to be here in Portland on health disparities about 2 weeks ago. And hearing a talk by Dr. David Williams from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health about health disparities that was absolutely mind-blowing. It should be up on the web shortly, and when it is, I'll make sure that the committee gets a link to it and it's posted on OLIS, because it is one of the most enlightening, terrifying, and heartening talks I've heard in a very, very long time. I would imagine you would agree with me, Ms. Johnson.
Absolutely, Senator.
I thought it was a mind-blowingly good talk.
Yes, and that really, for us, for the work that we do, affirmed the pathway that we are taking and taking that really foundational approach. Yeah. And telomere health was very frightening. Yeah. I'm 55 years old by calendar year, but 62.5 by telomere years.
Yeah.
So
the constant weathering of
oppression.
It's really remarkable data, really remarkable. And it gives us a really clear roadmap for some of the things we can do to address some of the disparities that certain communities have faced for altogether too long.
So. Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you,
all
Senator.
Right. We're going to need to wrap up, I think. Are you good?
Basically
good?
Yes. As long as you are good.
I think we're pretty good. Representative Lanzaleon, any final comments?
Yes. Actually, I would like to make a request to continue, I would say probably part two of the presentation, because I think we have some more slides that I'd love for our directors to complete, particularly DHS, because she gave me a lovely presentation, and I think we barely got started.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of great work that's been happening, so I'd love to invite her back to come and complete her presentation. But I want to thank you all for being here today. Having gone over our time says that you're doing a lot of amazing work, and the future conversations need to occur. And so I'm really proud and excited of the work you're doing, and you guys are good examples of what other agencies should be doing in respect to equity and inclusion and diversity. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you again.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
And Representative, we'll do our best to continue the conversation depending on the committee's available time. Thank you all very, very much for your work in preparing these presentations and the time that you took to come meet with us today. Okay. Any other business before the committee? Next week, what's our schedule look like at this point, Ms. Ames?
At this point, we only have Wednesday scheduled, and that will be a joint meeting with the Education Subcommittee on Early Learning. But as decisions get made, things will get posted, and I'll just let you know as soon as I can.
Thank you.
But you know you always have 48 hours. So.
Yeah. Thank you very much. We're adjourned. Thanks.